Welcome to Word Theater Weekly, where each Saturday we share stories from our archive of live performances of the world's best short stories recorded in LA, New York, and London, brought to life by great actors. I'm your host, Cedaring Fox, Word Theater's founder and artistic director. Please note that Word Theater holds the copyright to these recordings, so no portion of anything you hear may be reproduced without permission. This week, we had the special treat of having Steve Almond, the author of today's offering, The Pass, join us via Zoom to share some thoughts about his story. I'm going to go ahead and let Steve take it away.
My name is Steve Almond. I'm a writer of short stories mostly, and the author of the story, The Pass, which you're just about to hear. And this is a weird story in my little damp universe of stories, because especially in the collection that The Pass is in, My Life in Heavy Metal, there are a lot of first-person stories that are about the suffering of desire, which means there's a lot of dirty parts to it. And I was very focused on this, the way we throw our bodies in front of our hearts. But mostly they're told from a first-person point of view, and you're getting this very subjective version of romance and its discontents. The Pass was like an experimental story for me, because I was interested in writing about the moment when a potential lover announces that they're interested in somebody, the frisson of, will the pass be accepted? I think this story, listening to it now, is a different story, because we now know that, especially in the world of film and Hollywood, the announcement of a desire when there's unequal power is quite fraught, especially if it's a man and a woman or somebody who's in a position of authority. I don't think I was thinking that when I was writing this story. I was thinking about how vulnerable a person is when they are in whatever context announcing to somebody else, I don't just like you as a friend. I don't just like you as a fellow traveler. I am drawn to you. I want to make something romantic and physical happen. It's such a moment of tremendous vulnerability. And rather than writing from just one person's point of view, I was interested in six different little mini stories where the central character is the pass itself, is that liminal moment of a kind of request with a gesture or a caress or a word spoken softly that says, I'm putting my heart on the line here. Are you picking up the rope of love, or are you setting it down or throwing it away? And it's part of the reason that, to me, I always think of it as sort of an outlier and also really exciting. The first half of the story is the pass is made, and the second half is the suspense of, will the pass be successful, or is this a love that's not going to happen? And it's part of the reason that it's really delightful to hear an actor perform it, because I don't have a particular voice in mind. It's the voice of all of us as we struggle to figure out whether we can find love in the long term or even in the very short term, and just how tremendously vulnerable and hopeful. We're carrying what I call the burden of hope. And in the second half, you sort of figure out what happens in each scenario. I love the way that this is performed. The actor is able to kind of inhabit both the philosophical voice that's musing on all this, but also the individual fates of the characters as they're moving through these delicate, precious, angst-filled moments. So I'm really delightful to have this, a chance to listen to it again and for you to listen to it as well. I think you're in for a treat.
Thank you, Steve. And now here is Steve Almond's The Pass, performed by Robert David Hall.
A man in a bar makes a pass at a woman. It's not a good era for passes, but he's giving it his all. His eyebrows have been laying groundwork for hours. His voice, a nice voice, he's been told, a radio voice, lingers on her name. She's on her third drink, and she's here, isn't she, with him, and not somewhere else. And he's finally removed... And she's finally removed the purse from her lap, on which it had sat like a small guard dog. They're downtown someplace, some downtown someplace, the skyscrapers blazing like exorbitant lamps, subway trains hurling their human cargo past, lake wind breathing concrete and car exhaust, dusk punching out. He's Bill or Mike or Chuck. She's Rachel, Liz, Michelle with one L. She has a beautiful name. He's told her so and now leans in close enough to smell the Clamato on her breath. He hopes to appear smooth and audacious, like Brando or Valentino. She stirs her Bloody Mary with an odd precision, as if being evaluated. He touches her arm with just his fingertips. Will she consent to the pleasure they might take in all this? The lifting of their bodies, the lying of them down, the pale revelations, wetness dispatched outward, all of it. With his hand and mouth, both, he asks her to share in the complicated electricity of the moment. They have met before, these two, or two very much like them, at a costume party several years ago. She was dressed as Salome with seven veils and a wispy black bra. He was a caveman. She lowered her painted eyes and spoke in the way of a biblical mall. He said, "Onga bonga bonga." She swung her hips and made her veils flutter. He dragged her by the hair to a dark back room. Wishes he had. But why a bad era for the pass? Because the pass is what semioticians would call a lapsed signifier, that which once defined the act. An attempted breach of the culture's sexual mores has been overrun by the horny course of human affairs. It is not that nothing is sacred anymore. On the contrary, more is sacred than ever before, because more of the self is hidden away than ever before. But the pass no longer aims in the direction of anything hidden. It has become overt, incurably so. A woman awaits her flight to Denver, efficiently rouged, screwed into a stylish black pantsuit. But thunderheads have kicked up, and those ninnies at the FAA have the incoming circling, and God knows how long this will take. So she repairs to the eager banter of the terminal bar. She is a woman slightly older than her initial impression, shrewd in the matter of lighting. She settles in at the dim end of the teakwood bar, next to a man in a rumpled suit, another captive, and orders a screwdriver. They are not drinkers, but they have time on their hands, and now the communion of ill tempers. Judgment is passed on the vagaries of their airline, the bartender's matted chest hair, the focus group decor. Intolerances line up nicely. Together, they listen to a New York matron bellow into a payphone, sounding like a motherless calf. He makes a gentle observation about the indolence of the janitorial staff. On the wall above them, a poster of Casablanca, Bogey and Ingrid on that backlot tarmac, draped in pink fog, doing their utmost to dignify lurid hope. And outside, in the crowded bay beyond the X-ray machines, couples trapped in farewell holding patterns, wearing travel outfits and travel hairdos and lip gloss, the women smudgy, the men guarding goodbye erections. He has a certain gangster handsomeness, Mr. Rumpled Suit, his broad face pressed back, a nose she imagines had been broken, clear brown eyes. His hands are large and pleasantly scarred. Around his ring finger, not a ring, but a pale band. She orders another screwdriver. He hurries off in search of information about departure times. He has a deposition to oversee in Pittsburgh. She finds that she misses him. Odd. Yet there can be no other way to explain the elation she feels when she spots him edging past the luggage cart return rack, his rumpled trousers, and inside them, his thick legs. "Bad news," he says, "I have a wife." Or, "We will only hurt one another." Or, just possibly, "No more outgoing flights." In this third case, her hand will slip onto his thigh for the joy of feeling astonished movement under her fingers, flesh awaiting further instructions. But these are strangers, and the possibilities of the pass tempt them with no afterthought. At a party in a suburb renowned for its outdoor sculpture, a group of co-workers share red wine and veggie dip. They know one another in the way modern workers do, a forced animation of concern. Some are married, another single, and each group covets the other. A life too full of choices has rendered them indecisive. They're prosperous on the scale of their parents, but lack the rootedness that might fortify their hopes. They live in apartments and spend hours on the phone deciding things. Where to eat, what movie to see. They enter into relationships that feel as much as anything like arrangements. They are poorly versed in the mechanics of regret. In this domain, the pass requires something of a darkling's charm. The man about to make the pass, Jeff, is seated at the center of a comfy living room. The woman, Elena, is on the couch above him. She has the face of a Modigliani, exotically crooked, long and pale, cow-eyed. There has been speculation about her breasts in the office. They sit suspiciously high, but he is more taken by her backside, which is plump, cupidinous. Elena's boyfriend is in the kitchen. He is a nice fellow with a large mole on his chin. He sometimes makes the mistakes of his small-town rearing, a certain misguided exuberance in dressing or off-color joke. Jeff's girlfriend on the stairs is a sophisticate, versed in city tropes, an unembarrassed practitioner of seduction. When Jeff first started sleeping with her, her fierce scatology, the way she demanded to be slapped, thrilled him. More recently, he finds her vehemence frightening. They are a happy couple, Jeff supposes, as happy as couples tend to be. But there is an innocence about Elena that pricks his vanity, makes him jumpy for what he doesn't have. She is tipsy and agreeable, and words are his allies. He steers the conversation toward intimate topics, massages, body piercing, sensual ambition. "I think you know some things," he tells her. "I watch you move through the office, and I think you know some things that most people wouldn't think you know." She rolls her eyes. "So many guys talk about your chest. I'm sorry. I don't mean to embarrass you. Please don't be embarrassed. There's a loveliness there that makes them curious, that's all. You can't blame them for that, but I think they're missing it, Elena. I think with you, it's the lower body, the nalgas. I've been meaning to tell you this for a while. I know it's not right, but I watch you walk through this office, the way you move, and I think I'm not sure I can go through my life without knowing." And there are the provinces in which everyone does go about finding out. Clusters of college graduates knotted at the bottom of tall cities, trying to invent community. Everyone has slept with everyone, and they all drink together, hoping the alcohol and the music will restore some previously eluded glamour or obscure its dissipation. Those few who haven't coupled operate at a disadvantage, edgy and prideful, untrammeled by ease. They watch the others sweat and sway, and imagine a daisy chain of limbs themselves missing out. In this stewing lies the seed of future passes. But what lies ahead is not our concern. Our concern is present, the glorious now, the moment of erotic transfer, isotopic, dangling, a question mark, awaiting exclamation. In a rundown Stuttgart nightclub, two privates in the U.S. Army have arrived to hear jazz, arrived separately. They are from different divisions, have never met. The club is in the historic district, miles from the beer gardens where their comrades fill themselves with liters of pale Pilsner and oily sausage, counting colored bills for later descent on the hookers of this drizzled, ashen city. Technically, it's not even jazz on display in this blue-lit club. It's cabaret, the music of campy self-announcement, feather boas and top hats and tulle stockings and whorish makeup. and each of the privates drinks in the burly innuendo, sipping at sophisticated drinks, sneaking glances at each other, wondering. Between acts, the one named Shane spots the other leaning against the bar, uniform neatly tucked, back curving gracefully, the muscles under his shirt shifting like dunes. Shane bites on a piece of ice, moves to join him. They talk about where they're stationed, what their hitch is, awkward beginning things. The lights vanish, and another round of drinks gets drunk, and another set of skits begins. More good time tunes set against a black velvet curtain. A tall tenor with pasted on mustache, and a chanteuse treated rather sadly by the years, though they agree, surely lovely as a maiden. The hours roll by and the drinks loosen them, and soon they're confessing which high school shows they were in, bursting into stagey refrains. The hour is close to curfew, but the closing spectacle is more than either private could have expected. The old singer is up on the bar, flashing her fallen thighs, and the tenor is leaping from table to table in patent leather wingtips, and the two privates are suddenly at the center of a spotlight with a microphone under their chins, thrown together in voice, led laughing through a wobbly chorus of Auf Wiedersehen by the older patrons. Shane turns to his new companion and breathes the hot breath of want, and with nothing so much as this, asks to be folded into this stranger's body and kept there for the night. This is what the whole business is about. Night. Without night, its hungering canvas, its needy musk and daring sediments, without all this, the amorous among us would fold our tents and, like Longfellow's Arabs, as silently steal away. He met her through a mutual friend, and now she is in his home and he is cooking for her, chopping mushrooms and boiling water for pasta, washing the cupboard dust off his wine glasses. He has learned to cook a few meals from TV chefs and knit these into the tight circle of his life. His business, consulting, sucks him through airports and phones and flights and conferences and beepers and burgers and sour suits, and occasionally he suspects he is missing something. Not daughters or wives or azaleas, but the sense of his body, the sense of his body as experienced against another. Night illuminates this need, tenders it, demands a dividend. This woman in his apartment, she is what, a nurse or a stenographer, a piano teacher. She exhibits patience worthy of a bygone era. He sees her traveling the Oregon Trail in a long, plain dress, mending things. Her fingers are strong, able-looking. There is something steadying in the way she holds her Chardonnay cupped in both hands. She leans against the fridge carefully. Her eyes seem to want to dip beneath the surface of his words to more telling information. She is not someone he thinks of as pretty. There are flaws, which his life surrounded by advertising draws out, distorts. Slight overbite, flat bottom, saggy arms. The defects are not small. But then there is him. Sometimes before bed, he catches sight of himself in the bathroom mirror and sees his father. They are here because he invited her. Night fell around him. His first one home after a cross-country trip, and something in the yellowing of the street lamps outside his building left him bereft. He remembered his friend pressing this woman's number onto him, how he had avoided calling her, thinking, she must be desperate. When he finally got her on the phone two nights later, he was the one who felt desperate, trying to play the idea off as an impulse. He continues to chop, and she pours herself more wine and moves around his apartment, inspecting. He knows about her. She's been married before. She has a child who's away for the week. She's the same age as he is. He knows about her. She glances at his stack of unopened mail as if she would like to sort through it, as if she doesn't quite trust him to separate the junk from the significant. He puts the knife down and tilts up his wine, stopping when he feels a slight burn against his gums. He slips out of his shoes and approaches her from behind, and her neck is there, warm. He knows this could only happen from behind, that he is sneaking up on himself as much as her. He closes his eyes and hopes. Or a wedding. Sure, why not? They still hold them. Big, distracted, churchy affairs glittering with pearls, or earnest, runty ones on damp lawns. The nudnik photographer, the sweaty caterers, weeping mothers and black sheep beckoned back, the bow-tied band and the bride and groom helpless with goodwill. It still goes on in all these places, San Leandro and Mount Kisco and Wallingford, and at the fringe of it, behind the rectory or out near the pool, a bridesmaid stares ardently at a groomsman. They've had much to drink, as weddings recommend. She is so proud of her friend, she says, and the groomsman agrees. It is something to be proud of. She is so beautiful, yes. Never seen her so radiant, yes. Beautiful, and him, too. He didn't look so tall in the photos. How tall is he? 6'3"? Wow! He is thinking about the bachelor party. About the stripper called Danielle, between whose breasts his nose spent a brief and thrilling span, shocked at the scent, shoe leather and cinnamon, and the firmness of whatever held them aloft. This moony bridesmaid with her wedge of a face and colored contacts, her peach chiffon dress and matching pumps, she is no Danielle. She is a creature in sad real time. Her nakedness cannot be anything men would pay to see, though men, if protected by payment, will look at almost anything. And anyway, she is here before him, full of crab ravioli and champagne, swallowing back burps and twisting her bangs between her fingers. She hasn't the will to execute the pass. She can only display her markings, touch her body in ways that might induce in him a mimetic response. He is at his leisure to consider this, to ease back on his ankles and assess the pros and cons. She is homely, there is that, but her homeliness weighs on him favorably, accents his moderate beauty. This is a wedding, and there is drink, and hopes run deep on such occasions, but not so expectations. All pageantry inspires fantasy, no matter how shabby. And besides, she is wearing those prim peach pumps, shoes that will never be used again, that almost demand to be torn off, bitten at in mock depravity. He is not certain about kissing, though not just yet. And so he lowers his hand down the front of her dress and lifts her breast so that it puddles in his palm and so that he can hear his name on her tongue. In every life, such deciding places must be reached, especially in this era of frantic indecision, with its impatient sun and hammering moon, with its pathological ulteriority, when it seems a wonder that two people might ever agree to anything like terms. Day after fallen day, these odd, delicious moments on which so much depends, unwrapped like prepared pears, held close to nose, sniffed, tasted. In the downtown bar where Bill or Mike or Chuck has pinned his hopes on the sleeve of Rachel, Liz, Michelle, a failure he could not have foreseen. For if he had, why should he have invited her here and spent his money and time and dwindling predator energy? She looks at his hand on her arm and smiles politely. She sighs, and in her sigh invokes the nearest cliché. Nothing personal, a bad time, still recovering, just met someone. He envisions her dressed as Salome, the dance of her veils. If this were physical trauma, the endorphins would come sloshing in to spare him. He would not hear the chant of looming humiliation or feel suffused by brittle hate for this woman, who is no longer a woman, only something that he will never have. The electricity in his arm, with which he hoped to jolt her into panting collaboration, shuts down. The bartender freezes. The skyscrapers go dark. The set is struck. The airport pair have no such trouble. The airlines, after all, have arranged passage to a nearby hotel. Inside his room, the man who looks like a gangster shucks his suit, steps into the shower. Pleased at the water's scalding pulse, emerging pink, soapy. On his bed, the woman who missed her flight to Denver. She is in towels, one around her chest, one swirled on her head. Older, with her makeup scrubbed, her flesh unbundled. Nothing like Ingrid Bergman with her slender white nose and her shadows. Nothing like his wife, for that matter, who drinks protein shakes and runs half marathons. Nothing like anyone he could have ever seen himself lying beside in a hotel room near the airport. And for this reason, an object of intense fascination to his body, which responds along predictable lines. They are not graceful or pretty. He lunges, she groans. They press together. The entire project fills no more than a few minutes, but when he reaches for one of her castaway towels, she grabs his wrist. "Wait," she says. "I like to let it dry." This, more than anything, more than his refusal to bestow upon her a goodnight kiss, more than his stiff retreat from her mouth, more than the silent next morning shuttle ride, will haunt him. He has always worried that he looked like a thug, ever since his nose was broken by a bully in high school. The sight of his ejaculate spattered on her belly jolts loose a memory. This bully staring hard at a pornographic photo in a mildewy gym now 30 years ago, announcing, "That broad is a waste of good sperm." And what of Jeff, at the center of the warm suburban home, unspooling his patter to Elena, who looks like a Modigliani? He too has misjudged, and he too will suffer a mortification, though not of the flesh. He reaches for her ankle, and she pulls away, and his chest stumbles. She stands quickly and moves to join her boyfriend in the kitchen. Soon it will be announced to those assembled that the couple are engaged, and still later he will see the two of them outside nuzzling against a car. Closer to morning, with his own girlfriend curled away from him, Jeff will see things as they are. That he coveted Elena's innocence not as a thing to defile, but as a remedy. Beneath the fantasy of ravaging her was the fantasy that she would rescue him, stroke his brow, and somehow cure him of his tired contempt for everything. With her, he might have become the sort of man who desires purely, rather than the sort who seeks betrayal at the center of a foolish party. He will never feel quite sure of himself again. The old torch singer is surprised and pleased by the presence of two young American soldiers. She dispatches the proprietor of the club to invite them backstage. The madame would like to say hello after she has changed. PFC Shane and his companion are led to a small room and seated on an old love seat. The light is soft, roseate. There is the pleasant, cherryish smell of pipe tobacco. Their thighs brush. But now Shane wonders if this might not be an elaborate setup. He has heard tell of such things, MPs descending with billy clubs. And then, too, there is the ambiguity of his new friend's responses. A fluttery hug in the shadows, that lopsided grin, which could mean anything. When you are a soldier like PFC Shane, you learn to love quickly, to grasp and gulp and be done with it. Besides, there is the curfew to be considered. Now the diva makes her appearance, shorter than she seemed on the bar, modestly wrapped in a chenille robe, French cigarettes in a silver case, a cocktail in a tall goblet. She lived for a number of years in Houston, Texas. Do they know the place? An oil baron kept her as his mistress, all quite scandalous. She was terribly lonely in her glass and marble flat on Carr Street, like a princess in her tower. This all baron her imitation makes them giggle, used to come and pounce on her, fat and hairy as a woodchuck, with a prick like a jackass. When you are young, she says, it all seems enough, but love is the most important thing of all. Don't you agree? How old are you, boys? Really, that young? Well, it's time you learn the first rule of love. Never hide. Love must be acknowledged by the touch of days. And here she makes her exit, leaving them her dressing room and the time to decide for themselves. What a trip, Shane says. Yeah, says his new friend. Pretty amazing. The boy's arm falls across Shane's shoulders. His mouth is a wet red arrow. Yeah. The consultant has placed his lips to her neck, and she has responded with the consent of her body, turning against him, lifting her face. She is there and ready, but now he is unsure. The past sits wrong with him, plunging dread where the flutter should be. All he can imagine is the moment after physical release, when the soul, the patient's soul, reasserts sovereignty. This is the war that never ends. The body's simple needs set against the soul's Byzantine wants, each accusing the other of insufficient grace. No, no pass should suffer such sad scrutiny. She senses the slackening of his muscles and slumps onto the couch. It is called a pass because there is a movement of one desire past another. But the desires of this couple sit still as stone and stare down on both of them, and the best they can manage is a kind of door need. We should do this again, the consultant says. Sure, the piano teacher says. I'd like that. There is a long pause. He doesn't know what to do with this. In his off-site seminars, they tell him to attack the lulls, tell a joke, make a comment about the weather. But listening to the sad, uncertain timbre of her voice ruins his focus. Anyway, he says. Right, she says, sure. The young couple at the wedding, the bridesmaid and the groomsmen, they have no such difficulties. Not yet. For the moment, they are tongues and tails and hips and hands. The arm of night lowers itself over the rectory, turns the swimming pool into a small blue jewel. They have pressed themselves against the side of a building, tumbled into the shallow end, staggered to the nearest flat surface. Her peach chiffon dress is bunched around her thighs. His rented gray suit is split down the middle. The body. And the dizzy players that spin across this smooth field. They are all of them to be applauded. Nights are long, an entire lifetime of long. And the pass, here, now, a merciful lantern which lights the way, softly dims and drags us toward dream.
We love The Pass by Steve Almond, another great Pushcart Prize-winning story, and hope you did too. Steve Almond is the author of 12 books of fiction and nonfiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. His first novel, Which Brings Me to You, co-written with Juliana Baggett, is a major motion picture starring Lucy Hale and Nat Wolff. His last novel, All the Secrets of the World, is in development for television by 20th Century Fox. In addition to being published in the Pushcart Prize Best of the Small Presses, Steve's work has appeared in the Best American Short Stories, Best American Mysteries, and the New York Times Magazine, among many other publications. His most recent book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, is about craft, inspiration, and how to keep going at the keyboard. If you're a fan of books that walk on the wild side, check out Steve's do-it-yourself book, Writs of Passion. We won't tell anyone. Thank you, Steve. And a big thank you to Robert David Hall for his tantalizing performance of The Pass. Robert has been gracing our screens with his powerful presence since 1983. He won over audiences with his portrayal of Dr. Al Robbins in CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, which garnered him 4 SAG nominations. Thank you, Robert. If you're enjoying Word Theater Weekly, you'll find books by the authors we feature on bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater, or simply search WORDTHEATRE. We hope you'll tell your friends about us. If you are listening today, Saturday, March 9th, and happen to live anywhere near Los Angeles, please join us at the Fernando Pullum Community Center for a remarkable production of Black Folk Could Fly, an adaptation of Randall Keenan's essays from his book with the same name. We've got fabulous musicians and 4 extraordinary actors, Tracy Toms, Don Norwood, Eugene Bird, and CG. All the information is on our website. And then, Word Theater is coming to New York on March 19th. We've got 4 fabulous authors, Jacqueline Woodson, David Means, Sadiq Fofana, and Dashiel Carrera, whose stories will be performed by Marinda Anderson, Tim Blake Nelson, Michael Boatman, and Lou Diamond Phillips, respectively. It's time to wrap it up with some thank yous, first to philanthropist benefactor Ola Strom, to Glass Animals for our theme music, to the LA County Department of Arts and Culture for their ongoing support of this podcast. And thank you to all our wonderful interns, our podcast intern, Riley Fock, our executive coordinator, Scout Riley, and our podcast editor, Jason Lee. This is Cedaring Fox. Until next week, signing off.